Becoming more aware of a common consequence of chemotherapy.
In individuals with blood clots to the lungs, does dissolving them help?
Virtual autopsy.
And reducing inappropriate medication use in the elderly.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on May 2nd, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
And we'll reveal to our listeners that we're recording ahead of time because you and I will both be traveling when this is posted. But for today, we're in each other's presence, so this is quite a gift.
It is a pleasure to record in the same room with you.
I think so, too. So let's turn then to the studies, one that tickles me, and you said it was going to tickle me, and you were quite right, and that was virtual autopsy in Annals of Internal Medicine.
All right, so first of all, I have to figure out what about it tickles you, Elizabeth?
I just think it's such a great idea, because as we both know, the rate of autopsy has declined so much, and I think it's an opportunity that's missed. And so being able to employ these technologies to gain that data, I think is very important.
Elizabeth, you couldn't have said it better. Medical autopsy is the gold standard for quality control in clinical medicine. As clinicians, we miss about 15% of the diagnosis despite having all the available techniques at our disposal. As you mentioned, autopsies are not in vogue right now. Oftentimes, as clinicians, we feel uncomfortable asking family members, and oftentimes family members don't want to submit their loved ones to a post-mortem examination. So can we do a virtual autopsy and still increase our diagnostic capabilities? And that was the question that this study attempted to address. And they did it in a little bit of an unusual way. You said, well, gosh, we ought to be able to do a virtual autopsy by just taking, for example, a CT scan. But when we do that, we miss diagnoses that are related to the blood vessels. So this was actually an enhanced virtual autopsy. Not only did they do CT scans, but they also did injections in the arteries and veins. When they looked at 143 patients that were eligible, that had died within 48 hours of CPR in the hospital setting, they were able to identify 50 patients in whom consent was given to do a regular autopsy and also to do the enhanced virtual autopsy. And the virtual autopsy was able to confirm 93% of the diagnosis that were identified in the medical records. And that's better, by the way, than the medical autopsy, which confirmed 80%. In addition, the virtual and medical autopsy identified 16 new major and 238 new minor diagnoses, and many of those diagnoses were related to blood vessels. So in cases of unexpected death, the addition of this enhanced, or what's called multi-phase postmortem computed tomographic angiography, increased the diagnostic rate.
What's it cost?
The additional resources was about $300. Now, it did require a radiologist who was expert in the use of CT scans in the postmortem period.
I'd like to see the rate of uptake of this technique increase, just because I think, as I said, that we're missing an opportunity to really learn a lot of information. A lot of these imaging techniques identify things that may be occurring that we don't know about, and this could help solve these problems.
It could.
Excellent. Let's take a look at the New England Journal of Medicine and find out whether fibrinolysis or fibrinolysis, depending on which part of the country you come from, can be helpful for people who have pulmonary emboli.
Since fibrin is another word for clot, fibrinolysis is clot lysis or clot busting. The current estimate is that we'll make the diagnosis of pulmonary embolism in about a quarter of a million Americans this year. Currently, anticoagulation, medicines to prevent further clot, are the mainstay of therapy. Now, we know there's high-risk individuals. Someone's had sudden cardiac death or a markedly low blood pressure that have a high early mortality, more than 15%. And those individuals, the use of clot-busting medications or fibrinolytic therapy has proven to be beneficial. Well, this study addressed the next group. What about the intermediate group? People that haven't had frank cardiac arrest, but we know that the clot is so impressive, or the consequences are that it affects right heart function, or actually begins to cause some myocardial damage. So these are considered intermediate risk individuals. And they identified 1,000 of these intermediate risk individuals and randomized them to either routine anticoagulation with heparin or the use of fibrinolytic therapy to actually dissolve the clot. And what they discovered was that the patients who received fibrinolytic therapy had the same death rate as those that receive anticoagulation at 7 days and 30 days. But those that receive fibrinolytic therapy were less likely to have some sort of a hemodynamic compromise. Now, that was at the risk of significant bleeding, a 10 times higher risk of having significant bleeding, specifically an intracranial hemorrhage or a stroke caused by bleeding in the head. So overall, we really can't recommend the use of fibrinolytic therapy in individuals that are at intermediate risk following pulmonary embolism.
And of course, this is the group, almost irrespective of what condition we're talking about, those at intermediate risk, where we really need definition. So I think this is an important study for that reason.
It is, because oftentimes these individuals are treated with this medication.
Okay, so let's turn from here then to something I served up as a common complication of chemotherapy. That's peripheral neuropathy. This is in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. Is there anything to do about it?
Chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy occurs in as many as 40% of individuals that receive chemotherapy, especially those that receive multiple chemotherapeutic regimens. And if you've had a loved one that's had it, you know that can be very debilitating. It specifically affects the sensory nerves. So people can feel like it's tingling. To frank dysesthesias, that's very painful, where people feel like they're burning or they're walking on nails or glass all the time. And the question is, can we prevent it and or, if it's present, treat it? It's a position statement from the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And Elizabeth, you've already talked with one of our other colleagues about it, so you know there were several things about this that were actually a little bit disappointing. One is, we don't know what causes chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. Secondly is, there have been a number of agents that have been promoted to prevent it, but none of them have been effective. And then lastly, the studies that look at treatment have been fairly limited. They do recommend that duloxetin, also known as Cymbalta, can be effective in some individuals, but then they acknowledge that many of the other therapies, like tricyclic antidepressants, may be beneficial, but we don't know for certain. There aren't enough data. So overall, this was a statement put out there to at least raise the recognition, hey, we got a lot of work to do.
Clearly, this issue of cancer survivorship is, it's a success story. We're so good at really making cancer a chronic disease rather than an acute disease that results in death in a short time, that these kinds of things are really important. When somebody survives cancer, to whom do they go for care? Because they don't continue to see their oncologist generally.
You're right. After they've survived chemotherapy, they're oftentimes sent to their primary care physician, who throws up his or her hands and say, gosh, I don't know what to do. So we still have a lot of work to do.
And I would just add that, of course, as part of this position statement from ASCO, they also mentioned the prevalence of depression and fatigue in people who have been treated for cancer. So I think that there's a constellation of things we need to be aware of in folks who survive so that we can make sure that their quality of life is good after they've survived their disease.
I agree.
So finally, then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Benzodiazepines in the elderly. When folks are educated about these particular medications, they frequently say, well, you know, maybe I won't take them.
Most of our listeners are aware that in 2012, the American Board of Internal Medicine launched a Choosing Wisely campaign, and it was designed to help physicians and patients select which interventions should be discontinued. And one of those is the use of benzodiazepines, oftentimes used for people that have insomnia. They're particularly given to older individuals. That's the patient group that most likely suffers from insomnia. It's thought that somewhere between 5 and 30% of older individuals are taking benzodiazepines, and they comprise about 20 to 25% of inappropriate prescriptions in the elderly. So the question is, how do we decrease that use? They tried to reduce inappropriate benzodiazepine prescriptions through direct patient education. They took a group of about 300 older individuals that were going to the pharmacy to receive their benzodiazepine prescriptions. And half of the individuals received direct patient education. They were given booklets describing what happens to individuals that take benzodiazepines. And among the elderly, it sometimes interferes with cognition and increases the risk of falls and fractures. So they're given specific instructions about how to taper their dose. And they followed up with them 6 months later. This goes along with our current thought process about empowering patients to do things using what's called a shared decision model. After 6 months of follow-up, about 86% of individuals had actually completed the study. Of those, about two-thirds actually initiated conversations about discontinuing benzodiazepines, either with their physician or their pharmacist. And those that were enrolled in the active intervention, about 27% discontinued benzodiazepine use, as compared to 5% in the control arm. Of those that continued them, about another 11% actually decreased the dose as well. This is great news. This shows that direct-to-consumer education, normally used to increase medication use, was actually effective in decreasing benzodiazepine use.
I think think this is really good news.
This tells me that this program has universal application in the elderly.
And probably could be expanded to other populations as well who need to be tapered with regard to medications.
And is extremely cost effective.
Very good news. There's so many really interesting ones to do this time. I just don't even know what to do, but I think I'm gonna do the virtual autopsy because I really like that one.
It's got great pictures. I think our listeners will enjoy seeing them.
Excellent. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.